You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, September 26, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, writer, strategist, political analyst, Luke Thompson, a Republican, will talk about the Ted Cruz endorsement, the future of the Republican Party. We'll get another angle in on that. And we'll handicap what should happen in tonight's debate. What should be the approaches of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as they take each other on in the first general election debate of the cycle tonight at Hofstra University in Long Island. And of course, we will be covering that live tonight on our YouTube channel with coverage beginning at 8:30. Russian and Syrian forces pounding Aleppo. Are a third of both Trump and Clinton's Twitter followers fake? Yes, says a digital agency that tracked it. Palmer Luckey, who is that? Well, I'm sorry to have to explain to you who he is. He's a new money digital plutocrat who is involved with Facebook and Oculus, and he is behind a major meme machine targeting Hillary Clinton and promoting Donald Trump. I am Lake Ermia, a social media campaign takes on the environment in Iran. We'll touch on that, as well as more speeches from the UN General Assembly, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan, showing again that truly doesn't care. And we've got a bunch of sound. Mike Pence, he's still being wheeled out to try to translate Donald Trump. Chuck Todd says, what about, instead of Jennifer Flowers at the debate, why not someone that could truly humiliate and exploit Hillary Clinton? That and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Matt, will you do me a solid, or one of you? On my table is the copy for Harry's, which I need. Because as you can see, I have shaved. There is no beard, no stubble, no carefully disheveled look, nothing, just a clean shave. And the way I did that clean shave was with, of course, the best razor in the game, Harry's, which is why I'm happy to talk to you about them. What I love most about shaving with Harry's is that it's incredibly close and smooth, and I have sensitive skin, and there's never a problem. It just does the job. I use the Harry's foam. You don't have to use too much of it. You don't have to keep reapplying it. You're good. Good to go. Big razor companies have been the annoying habit of putting out new models and raising their already high prices. Unlike those guys, Harry's doesn't believe in upcharging, which is why they made their razors even better, and they're keeping prices exactly the same. Harry's five-blade razors now include a soft flex hinge for a comfortable glide, trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places, a lubricating strip, a texture handle for more control when it's wet. Still just $2 per blade compared to four and more you'll pay at the drugstore. By owning a factory in Germany where they make the blades, Harry's can produce high-quality razors themselves and sell them online for half of the price. And this is a special offer now for Majority Report listeners. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they'll send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, five-blade cartridge, shaving, and shaving gel. Free when you sign up for a shave plan. Just pay shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of the show. Enter code Majority Report at checkout and get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code Majority Report. We'll put a link to this on our blog. And check out your claim for free trial set and post-shave balm. That's harrys.com, code Majority Report. We have a...
I just got... I would like to make an announcement that I...
Yes?
That I just got a Harry's razor, and it's the best razor I've ever used, honestly. And I've spent money on the... Okay, that's enough of that music.
No, I like it. It's building the anticipation. Come on. I kind of know what I'm doing here.
We can really spend a lot of money on razors and women's razors and all the blades and all of this whatever. And I have sensitive skin. And it was... within the first second, I was like, wow.
Don't you, when you buy other razors, don't you feel like this? That's how I feel.
Yes, I feel very
And I feel exactly the opposite when I use Harry's. Fresh Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. We talked about Kaepernick spreading the brand responses of professional sports. On the positive side, more flexibility from the ownership and Pat and Goodell from the NFL. On the bad side, Carolina Panthers, as people know from listening to this show, have hired Frank Luntz to right-wing-asize that team. We also talked about Patagonia and why that, as a sort of socially responsible enterprise, points the way for the future. Fresh Two Dope Boys. Again, we've had some more new sponsors this week. And, new listeners, new people signing up with more great feedback. So if you haven't already, Two Dope Boys in a Podcast on iTunes or Two Dope Boys in a Podcast on Stitcher, the number 2. We'll be right back with Luke Thompson on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is a Republican political strategist and consultant and a partner at AppleCart. And, you know, I say this from time to time, and it's true. I do have a lot of people I'm friendly with as guests. But in this case, we're talking about a very good friend and a genuine chum, even though we're on the opposite sides of so many of these battles, but actually pretty much see eye to eye on basically everything that isn't politics. Luke Thompson. Luke, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael. I appreciate it.
It's great to be talking with you, man. Before I want to also sort of set the stage. I mean, everybody will remember, they know Right to Rise. That was the Jeb Bush PAC. And people will maybe be able to sort of game out from that you are a never Trump guy. So I'll sort of set the stage for you that way. And that actually sort of leads to our first question. Because, you know, there were sort of different ways of dealing with Trump. You have the Chris Christie, oh my God, sir, can I get you fast food?
And
you
can give, grab the shine box.
Let me grab the shine box. Anything that I could do. Anything I could do for you, Mr. Trump. Just please don't let me go to jail. I won't like the regimen in there. They have the Chris Christie bath. Then you have the, you know, Marco Rubio, it's dangerous that this man have nukes, but I'll endorse him, I guess, but in a kind of sulky way. And then, you know, credit where credit is due, and I loathe to give this credit, but you do have to give, you know, Jeb and John Kasich were both like, nope, this isn't going to happen. And then you had Ted Cruz, and this is just seems to be the nature of Ted Cruz. He produced his own weird, long-winded, somehow simultaneously self-righteous and incredibly cynical saga, which has now resulted in an endorsement of Donald Trump. Game that out for us.
Well, if you can come up with a coherent strategy behind this, you're a better strategist than I am.
Okay.
I mean, there's a cynical assessment, which is that Cruz was looking ahead to his 2018 primary, and Congressman Mike McCall, as well as Dancing with the Stars powerhouse and former Governor Rick Perry, were right. And look, credit where credit's due. Governor Perry has shown himself a capable dancer with the stars.
Some of us were not surprised by that.
Indeed.
Yeah.
No. But and he's stuck to his wheelhouse with I believe it was God Bless Texas and Green Acres as his opening two bits. Yeah. But anyway, I think that he was starting to feel like there was a great deal of pressure from donors as well as from people in Texas to fall in line. Mm-hmm. And to go back to your different types of endorsement for just a second, there is a category of endorsement that you left out there, which is the sort of institutional party endorsement that you see from somebody like Scott Walker or Paul Ryan or to some extent Rick Perry as well, where they say, look, I'm a Republican. He's the Republican nominee. The voters have spoken and I'm going to endorse our nominee. And I think that it was from that faction of people, people with no great affection for Trump, but who felt they had a sort of institutional duty to endorse him as much as they may have disliked him, that Cruz was getting serious pressure for the first time. I was in Cleveland for the RNC, and I was there for all of the big speeches. And, you know, I can tell you that that crowd was not enthusiastic about Trump. National conventions during presidential cycles are like the Super Bowl, and people are generally standing and they're screaming and they're going nuts. I mean, it's like as active a fan base as you can imagine for something that doesn't involve people inflicting traumatic brain injuries on one another.
Although maybe in this case, well, maybe, I mean, yeah, in some ways, Donald Trump is a massive brain injury on all of us.
I feel like that every morning.
Right.
But you know, it was a pretty staid operation. You had even delegates on the floor were sitting and kind of politely clapping and whooping occasionally, but it wasn't the sort of raucous environment you would expect. And that was the same crowd that had, you know, what was it, a day or 2 days earlier, booed Ted Cruz almost off stage. So how do you reconcile those two things? The fact that they're not really excited about Trump, but they were really, really angry about Cruz. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is that, you know, political parties for a lot of activists are these important pillars of their personal identities. This is true of Republicans and Democrats alike. Ideology is, I don't want to say a secondary consideration, but is wrapped up in this sense of membership and belonging to a team, that these are long-standing institutions of meaning and import in their lives. And I think that Cruz sort of kicked that hornet's nest when he walked up on stage and put his thumb in the eye of the party's nominee rather than either staying away or keeping his mouth shut, which is what Kasich and Bush and Bush did. So in that sense, I think Cruz was getting a lot of pressure from those people, sort of rank and file Republicans who don't like Trump, who he expected to appreciate his sort of stand. And between that and some major Cruz backers, as well as, and I think this is the most important, Perry and McCall making noise about a primary challenge.
Right.
He basically folded up because he didn't want to lose his Senate seat.
So he, yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of different aspects of this to sort of tease apart here. And I'll push back on a little bit of it, but I'm sort of less interested in that debate and more interested, though, in a question that arises out of that assumption, sort of even if we table that. But, I mean, so one hand we just have Ted Cruz as a personality. And he is, in my view, and I think many people's view, is just sort of, you know, he is a kind of distinctly unlikable and sort of off-putting personality. And he seems to, you know, his pattern is too clever by half. I'll sit back and I'll praise Trump and I'll let him rise because, you know, inevitably he'll implode and then I'll get his supporters. Then all of a sudden, you know, that blows up in his face to some respects. I'll make this play on Trump because I'm anticipating that he's going to lose by a landslide and the party will have to pick up the pieces and I'll be the natural guy to pick up the pieces. Of course, I think, you know, even for all of my low esteem of Republicans, if Ted Cruz is your answer after Donald Trump implodes, then that sort of would require kind of lobotomy services beyond, I think, any of our ability to sort of figure out. But the other point that's interesting to me, and I think gets on that institutional track, is, you know, obviously I disagree with you to some extent because I think that Donald Trump clearly did speak to a very significant base in the Republican primary. And in a primary when you have so many candidates and you really just need, you know, 35-40% to sail, he did. And that is a major part of the Republican coalition. But that said, you know, if from an institutional perspective you're willing to swallow the fact that this guy is, you know, let's be frank, a dangerous, racist, you know, nativist, in some ways, though, aren't you toxifying the brand more in the long term? Because in some ways, from an outsider perspective, you can say, you know, guys like Paul Ryan are saying that, you know, tax cuts or anything else, you know, trumps the fact that this guy's a bigot. So that when he says something like, oh, you know, that what Trump said about the judge is literally the textbook definition of bigotry, it sort of makes him look worse because it's like if I said something as unequivocal about a Democratic nominee on a sort of foundational issue like that, then first of all, how could I reconcile it in myself? And then secondly, in the long term, and I suspect this might be your view, isn't it actually worse for that institution in the long term if you care about it and you see a path for it that, you know, has something to do with just the sort of emerging America and different demographics and all the rest?
Personally, I mean, that's why we did a lot to try to stop Donald Trump from becoming the nominee. Unfortunately, you know, we had Senator Cruz actively promoting him and, you know, Senator Rubio in witness protection. Yes, I think he is a problem. The one thing that I'll say about Trump that makes him, shall we say, there are two factors that should be considered when we talk about long-term residual effects of a Trump nomination. The first is that we've got a two-party system, and governing a giant country like this one is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And as a result, things tend to fluctuate between the two parties regardless of whether or not a party has proven itself capable of or worthy of the esteem of the American people by default. But beyond that, drilling down into the specific case of Trump, in order for Trump to leave a lasting legacy, assuming he doesn't win in November, which I think we'll just assume that for the sake of argument, because anybody who says they know what happens in this instance of a Trump victory is prognosticating blind, having been spun around several times and fed, you know, a dozen shots of liquor. So operating from the assumption that Trump loses, what will the residual that he leaves within the party be? Well, he won't have much support because, one, he'll be a loser, and, two, he certainly wasn't well-loved coming in. He also doesn't appear to have a lot of institutional development. Let's put that politely.
That's such an interesting, that's an amazing way of phrasing it.
We'll try to be polite about it. I don't see him leaving a lot of durable facilities or individuals with deep networks that would continue to advocate on behalf of his quote-unquote policy agenda or even on behalf of his person after he goes. Now, having said that, he certainly dragged a legion of knuckle-dragging troglodytes out of the dark and into the public eye for the purposes of doing cable hits. And those people aren't going to go away. And certainly a lot of folks see Trump and see an opportunity to seize a moment in the national spotlight.
Oh, I think it's a media company, Luke. I think it's a media. I think that that's the name. I think Trump will almost certainly lose, and then I think you launch Trump media.
Trump, you know, it's possible.
Yeah.
I think it's certainly possible. I'm not sure he wants to work that hard.
Hmm.
I mean, remember, this guy actually hasn't run anything in his life. The Trump organization.
Well, he could just brand it like anything else. It's Trump media run by Steve Bannon and some other bigots. I mean, you know, sure.
Look, and Ailes is certainly vindictive.
And, Ailes is right there. Exactly. Right.
He would love to do nothing more than to drive a median line between InfoWars and Fox and try to bankrupt the Murdoch sons with whom he, has a long-running clash of views. But a media institution is a slightly different thing in terms of
they didn't want him to use the company as a sexual harassment slush fund, and he did. No, I'm just kidding.
Go.
Yeah, the difference of views. Anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Spying on reporters in Europe, one thing. Sexual harassment slush fund in the U.S.
Right.
No, but I think that, look, who among the RNC members is going to be a diehard Trump supporter after he loses? Who in Congress, other than a handful of members of Congress, you're really not going to see, and maybe Paul LePage, for whatever that's worth.
No, I bet. Right.
You're not going to see a lot of legacy Trump.
But isn't that... Okay, and actually, I'll connect this to the next place I want to get with you because this is also fascinating, and then we'll get to tonight's debate. But isn't that also the part of the I want to be more charitable than maybe I usually am, but if we said that there's a demographic problem here with the Republican Party, and it will not jeopardize running the House, right? Because of a variety of variables from, gerrymandering to districts becoming less, just less and less swing districts, people becoming a bit more sort of uniform in their politics.
Well, and white working class leaving the Democratic Party en masse, which has eliminated a lot of Democratic rural seats.
Well, maybe specifically the rural white working class. And I'm also not at all convinced. I find that the whole notion that Trump has spoken to a broader working class to actually be incredibly, not sort of supported by the numbers. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this campaign is it's starting to shape more and more to just look numbers wise like a standard presidential campaign. Like, if you stripped away the stories and the candidates, the numbers don't look terribly dissimilar from Romney, Obama, but regardless,
when you drill down, you will see differences, right? Like, I mean, Romney won white millennials. Trump is going to lose them.
Absolutely.
Romney won white college educated
right
women.
Those are the big differences.
Trump is at best going to tie.
Right.
Romney won white working class voters, or at least white voters without a college degree, by the teens. It looks like Trump is going to win them by the high 20s. So there have been demographic shifts within it, even if the overall margin doesn't really change.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the fair points. Those are important distinctions. But overall, there isn't this sort of like secret sauce that Trump has discovered to talk to with a sort of broader, proletariat interest, shall we say, right? But I think that the problem is in the demographic sort of, I know what Mike Murphy calls the demographic cul-de-sac, that sort of implicates not just Trump, though. I mean, it implicates him because, Trump looked at the playing field and he said, look, the Republican Party base is obviously overwhelmingly white. There's certainly a contingent of it that holds, strongly anti-immigrant views. Maybe some of them are outright nativists and bigots. Some of them might also be conspiracy theorists. You have actually some interesting numbers around that with Trump. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to stop speaking the subtext and also, stop speaking the subtlety. And part of the reason I think he can do that with ease is I think he is actually, a personally bigoted guy. If you took it more broadly, if you're overwhelmingly representing rural seats and your overwhelming base is this sort of white contingent that has a certain policy set and a certain cultural set, and you know that you need to expand beyond it, that you need to have an agenda that speaks to a much broader array of people, and again, from some center-right perspective, of course, but it's speaking to Hispanics, it's speaking to younger people, it's telling women and gay people a different message, how do you expand from your base when, that will alienate them, right? So it seems like, Trump is an extreme manifestation, but on the other hand, from that limited incentive structure, why doesn't, you know, it's not that people are going to be as crude as Trump, but I think there's a lot of Tom Cottons out there saying, who's, you know, a senator from Arkansas, an extremely right wing, and he's in a state like Arkansas, he's not going to come out and make fun of, you know, handicapped people, because there are some things that Trump just does because he's a uniquely terrible person. But the essential formula and sauce is a winning sauce in the Republican universe. And if your incentive structure is the Republican universe or a rural state, why move beyond it? You know, you're not trying to become governor of California.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a firm believer that you only solve this problem through the sort of organized combat of primary elections.
Okay.
So I'll cop to the demographic cul-de-sac. The one thing that I'll say about Trump that he indicates, at least looking forward, is this is a highly polarized country. Partisan ascriptive identities are extremely powerful, and even people who can't stand the guy are going to hold their nose and yank the lever for him, because that's the view that they take is any Republican over any Democrat. And what that says to me is that the sort of missing millions thesis that guys like Ted Cruz have been propounding for years, that there are, you know, several million dyed-in-the-wool conservatives who didn't come out for Mitt Romney because he was a squish, is utter nonsense.
Yes.
Because if anyone is the Republican nominee, they can count on getting the Republican vote, it seems. Conversely, I think Clinton is showing that even a candidate as perhaps uniquely untalented at appealing to people as Hillary Clinton is still going to get the Democratic vote.
Right.
So where the demographic cul-de-sac comes into play for the Republicans, I think it comes in on two fronts simultaneously. And this may be a little different than the analysis you hear from most people. So right now, for the first time in its history, the GOP has within its core coalition both the white middle class and the white working class. No political party's ever held those two groups together simultaneously in the history of this country. Now, if the Republican Party tries to hold those two groups together through white nationalism, they're going to fail. The white middle class has zero appetite for that. They don't want to be associated with it. I saw that glass. That was very amusing. Michael's drinking out of a Jeb glass.
Yeah, that's for you, buddy.
I appreciate that. If I had my video up, I'd show you I've got my Jeb 2016 mug right now.
Follow us on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll be inebriated.
The thing is the white middle class, the kind of managerial class, is not going to tolerate white nationalism as an ordering ethos. And right. So they're going to leave. On the flip side, the material interests of the white middle class are not the same as the material interests of the white working class, right? Mm-hmm. They are generally going to be pro-trade that brings down the cost of consumer goods, pro-immigration reform, et cetera. And so, you know, I'm not sure the GOP can keep those two constituencies together. Even if they can, if they do it at the complete exclusion of Hispanic voters, Asian American voters, and essentially signing off even a vestigial portion of the black vote, then forget
That's an important thing, though, even there, that even if you're only going for 15% of the African-American vote, the signal, like, part of the reason the Asian-American voters won't go near you is because precisely the signal of we're not even going to attempt to contest the African-American vote.
Exactly. No, look, I agree with that point. I mean, it won't surprise you that Murphy, my former boss, and I agree on a lot of these things.
Right.
But I think that the challenge is really twofold. It's not the growth and opportunity report after 2012 said, hey, okay, we've just got to stitch things up with Hispanic voters by passing immigration reform and everything would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really naive.
Yeah.
It was really naive, both because American political parties are giant entities that, you know, purport to represent just slightly more than half of the country. So they're going to be internally extremely diverse. And so propounding a lockstep program for a party is just a bad idea. You have to accept that there's going to be a lot of internal conflict and that internal conflict can be healthy. But more to the point, I mean, you have to, if you have a segment of your party that will not tolerate an attempt to win a governing majority at the presidential level, then it's incumbent on those who wish to win that governing majority to beat them repeatedly in primaries so as to delegitimize their political position. And unfortunately, the one thing that Trump has done is he has prolonged the kind of fight between the two wings of the Republican Party, or what I've called elsewhere the two separate Republican parties, from resolving itself.
So,
because both of them can kind of call this cycle a mulligan, come back again 4 years from now.
So, Luke, before we get to just the sort of we'll do our respective theories of what we think both candidates should do tonight, and I'm quite interested to hear what you say just as a political professional. But before we get to that, there's another element that I think is fascinating about Trump that you've critiqued the whole Trumpist movement on, and it's interesting because this is an area where you and I, from the sort of neo-fascist, far horrifying right that you represent, and from my sort of, devotion to Che and Mao that I represent, and admiration for Fidel. But that
I think it's a beautiful arm tattoo that you got of Fidel.
Yeah, well, there needs to be another 1,000 memberships, and then I'll show it. But and I mean to two dope boys. Which, by the way, I have to say, Luke is probably the number one Republican fan of Two Dope Boys in a podcast, and the only one. But hopefully he's sending it around those circles. But at any rate, you and I, from very different directions, both share a critique of this sort of elitist, no labels, fantasy, this sort of I would sort of just describe as essentially just somewhat socially liberal corporate politics that has no appeal in the country. It has no draw. And the only reason that it's sort of represented in media is because it indexes as the politics of most of a cable news green room, which is I'd like more of a tax cut, and I can sort of opine on quote unquote entitlement spending. But, I have a gay son and blah, blah, blah. This very kind of managerial sort of politics. And John Huntsman and Joe Lieberman, of course, are, they're both, in fact, pretty irrelevant figures at this point, but they're sort of presiding over that prestigious corpse. And one of the reasons, and Huntsman endorsed Trump, and the read that a lot of people gave that was the more sort of, charitable explanation was that, look, if Lieberman's going to eventually endorse Clinton, which he did, you need to have, the no labels guys need to be on both sides of this. I know you agree with that interpretation, but the more interesting one you have is that in some ways that this is another part of the Trump message. There's the nativism, the bigotry. I think he certainly is quite willing to, and I actually think in some ways if he does become president, he will sign on to a very, far-right Republican congressional agenda just because, he doesn't have an agenda and he'll just sign what's in front of him. But being that as it may, the other part of his argument and campaign has actually been a crude version of the same kind of no-labels sort of argument that we've heard before, just in this brash and bigoted package versus a boring Morning Joe package. Can you explain that a little bit?
So I would distinguish two things real quick, and then I'll dive in. So I think the kind of like managerial elite that a lot of the green room set likes is much more the Mike Bloomberg.
Sure, Mike Bloomberg.
It is sort of the no labels mentality.
Right.
I think the latter is much more Trump's wheelhouse. It's hard to do because there's so much blindingly hot and inflammatory rhetoric in Trump. But if you strip it away and you look at his core concerns, the ones that didn't just show up in this election cycle, but that he's been kind of, the saws that he's been running on for, 20 years, it looks a lot like Ross Perot. And it looks a lot like not populism, but what you might call centrism, right? So centrism in what I mean by that is this critique of the process as wholly and fundamentally corrupted, be it by, gerrymandering, campaign finance, voter fraud, this, that, and the other. It's a mentality that says that two things are at work in politics that have to be stopped. The first is that we have a corrupt system that divides an otherwise fundamentally unified population. Now, I sit there and I say this is a country of 320 million people. We span a continent. We're not fundamentally unified. We're going to disagree about a lot of things. That's healthy. That's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't view that as a failure of the United States that we don't agree on most things. But to Trump, actually, we do agree on most things. What's getting in the way are these elites. Mm-hmm. But then he turns around, and instead of a sort of populist message that says, so let's go crush the elites, he right. says, but you also have to understand the elites win by stirring up passions, by sort of inflaming our tribal viewpoints and making us these sort of passionate advocates for brands or labels or whatnot. And so what we need to do is get, you know, rational, calculating deal makers in place to make brokered agreements. Mm-hmm. And you can see how these two ideas take away the kind of racist overtones of Trumpism, sound a lot like the mission of somebody like Governor Huntsman, right. who, you know, and again, I have disagreements. I'm not going to uniquely criticize Senator Lieberman or Governor Huntsman for their project. It's their project. But I would say that they tap into a longstanding anti-party ideology that's been in the U.S. since the founding. And I think that Trump has really given voice to that, which is part of why he has to explain away problems by recourse to even insane explanations of foreignness, be this birtherism, be this, you know, immigrants pouring over the border, terrorists pouring over the border. There's no room in Trump's worldview to explain Americans just not getting along with one another or having basic disagreements.
Or the, you know, I mean, the quote-unquote right kind of Americans just getting along
right.
with each other.
Right, but,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
even Trump, right? Like, yes, he speaks to black Americans in the second person.
Yes.
Which is a dead giveaway that he
right.
views them as fundamentally different from himself.
Right.
But on the flip side, he speaks to them in the second person instead of in the sort of third person, which is how he treats Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans.
Right. Because black people are sort of belong here, but
yes.
they're a problem. And then it's – well, everything is, you know, it's just sort of like – I mean, it's so – it's like – I mean, you know, it's like a movie. It's like, you know, Arabs are – the Muslims are the terrorists. You know, the Hispanics are the border jumpers. The black people are the, you know, everything from this sort of just kind of extraordinarily condescending and bigoted pity to – objects of fear and you know and sort of almost like, you know, affable bigotry. And then, you know, Asian people and Chinese people are these, you know, they're like the great negotiators and they sit around in rooms and they make deals, you know.
Bigger point though is that like you have to understand that Trump's basic view of American demography is a pre-1965 Immigration Act view,
yeah.
where something like 98% of the population was either white or black.
Right.
And that was it.
Right.
And he speaks a language that is familiar to the kind of ethnic politics of that period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think to recognize that is to recognize the way in which he's invoking some pretty old stuff, right?
Yep.
I mean, he's pulling things that Americans have believed for a very long time. Americans like to think that we're fundamentally united as a people. Every revolutionary political culture has this view, right?
Mm-hmm.
Americans like to believe that reason triumphs over passion. They're totally understandable. But when you bring these things together, I think they create what you might call a politics of anti-politics.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump has really run on that. He's run on saying politics is not the way we resolve social conflict in a large, diverse country. Politics is the source of social conflict.
And the source of incompetent people and people who don't know how to make deals and blah, blah. So he gives you a very kind of crude version of that, along with white nationalism and bigotry, and then the fact that he's, you know, good on TV. And there you go. Okay, if you're advising Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, respectively, what do they each need to do tonight, and what are their kind of respective pitfalls?
Sure. So, I mean,
I know that you would really be literally physically ill if you actually had to do this for either of them.
All
but
right.
this is just an exercise.
I'll put a brave face.
Yes, it's just the in the words of some of our favorite people that we like to mock on the show, a thought experiment.
A thought experiment. Okay. Yeah. Well, first of all, Donald, do not refer to Hillary Clinton using an Anglo-Saxon word. If you can avoid doing that.
Yes. Seems like a good place to start.
Yeah, let's start there. No, I think, you know, anytime you're going into a debate, there are two overarching considerations. The first is, what are the points you've got to get across regardless of who you're debating? You know, what are your five core points, three core points, whatever they are? And you really need to get those across. So I think if you're Trump, those are, I'm an agent of change. So if you're sick of the way things are right now, I'm change. She's not.
Right.
I think it's you really want to get across probably some sort of substantive point insofar as he's capable of that, which is I think trade might be the best contrast piece for him.
Yes, I agree.
You know, Hillary's taken 80 different positions on this issue. I've always had one. I say the trade deals are killing us, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
And then I think the third thing, if I'm telling Trump, is do not let her bait you. Like, just stay calm, deliver these points over and over again, security and prosperity, and do not let her bait you, because that's what she's going to try to do. If you're Clinton, I think you go in and you want to make a handful of points. The first is you really need to establish that you're able to do the job in a way that isn't totally self-serving. And I think that the skepticism of Clinton is not that she can't do the job, because most people would say, all right, look, you know, other than people who've actually been president, she's held as much or more real power.
And she's very smart, and she's you know, all this stuff is kind of obvious, you know.
Yeah, basic a lot thresholds. Of that's baked.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to go in and say, you know, you can play to some extent the fact that people wail on you incessantly, your opponents do, to your advantage. And you can say, look, I keep staying in here even though people call me names all the time. Mm-hmm. Because this really matters to me, and I want to make sure that we can, you know, get – probably she'll use some language about middle-class people, an opportunity to see their wages grow, et cetera. The second thing I think you want to do is engage the moderator on detailed questions whenever you get an opportunity. So if Trump begins to fumble a question, I think it's fine to step in there and say, well, Donald, I think what, you know, he meant was X, Y, and Z, as a way to kind of – don't be afraid to feel like the teacher's pet. I know that that's a real concern of Clinton's people, that they don't want to be the – what is it? The Tracy Flick character. But right. I think that's overdrawn. Like, it's perfectly fine to be competent. But then I think the third – yeah, right. I know. Welcome to 2016.
Right, right.
But then I think the third and final thing, and this is really critical, is you've got to needle Trump, and you've got to knock him off of his comfort zone. Assume that he's going to come in well-positioned, but recognize that the guy gets tired. 90 minutes is a long time. He's going to have a hard time keeping his focus.
He's start panting. Yeah. I can't. I'm tired. Lester Holt's a black guy. I thought I was always nice to him.
Right. So, you know, what do we know sets Trump off, right? Like, we know making fun of his Potemkin fortune will set him off. So say something like, Donald plays a billionaire on TV, and I think he'd really like to be one. But, you know, we know that that will make him crazy. You make fun of how little money he has.
You know and what? Sorry, finish your thought.
Yeah, sure. I think the other thing is he cannot stand having wanted something and not gotten it. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a couple of lines pre-baked in, I think you can deliver those. And then, you know, the last thing is just Trump has complicated reactions to women. On the one hand, it seems like he'll listen to women when he won't listen to men. On the other hand, he clearly holds some pretty awful views.
He's like a total misogynist. Women. Yes.
Right.
So, on the other hand, he's a if you were writing a screenplay, it would be like, that's a little on the nose. You should probably make that guy slightly more subtle in his sexism.
Let's tone it down.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that you don't want to walk into a trap, right? You don't want to hand him something that lets him just point, you know, say, I look at my daughter, right? I don't hate women. But I think that you
I'd be like, look at your daughter. Yes.
Yeah, we know he does that.
Yeah.
But I think you just, if you needle him on those three things a little bit and you knock him off of his comfort zone, it's possible that you can get him to kind of break that first thing that I mentioned and get him to sort of react in a fashion that just looks awful.
Yeah, I mean, there are two things, though. I don't agree entirely on Hillary's strategy. I think you're totally right on Trump's strategy, though. You know, another point that you and I have kind of gone over and you've made in other conversations, which I agree with, in some ways, the basic problem that Trump faces is that the territory that makes him, you know, distinct and interesting and compelling is the same zone where he's going to say things that to a broad national audience are unacceptable. And then when he's sort of showing you that he can be serious, then it's like, oh, this is just Mitt Romney, except not nearly as good. And I actually think that, you know, who, and let's be real here, it wasn't like Mitt Romney was some great popular candidate. But I think with Hillary, and I actually agree with Sam on this. We were talking about this on Ari Rabinhoff's show on Sirius this morning. The weird thing about this campaign, and I just mean this purely tactically, you know, that in the fact that the Clinton campaign has chosen to run on this message that there's something uniquely, you know, wrong about Trump and we're going to reach out to Republicans and this and that. The reality is that, again, we've seen in the numbers, and you're right that there's subtleties inside the numbers, and I do think, like, yes, there's, you know, college-educated women who might have voted for Republicans in the past. They specifically are just – they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. And there's – you know, so some of that – but I don't know that you need to run a campaign talking to them for them not to run against – not to vote for Trump, right? Like, that's already highly unlikely just because if they have any exposure to Trump, they know who he is. He's repulsive. But I think that, you know – besides that, the numbers are starting to look a little bit more like, as I say, a kind of conventional race. And what she needs to do in the debate is almost not get into, you know, you can tweak them, you can be dismissive, but I think, like, don't get into that game. Just be like, you know what, Donald, like, I have a new proposal on the estate tax. And maybe then, if you can't resist it, you can, you know, accept his numbers. There was a funny thing in Politico where they fact-checked Hillary Clinton because in her new state tax proposal, she's talking about the money that the Trump family will pay in her proposal. And Politico fact-checked her because they said she's using, like, the misleading stat of Trump's own self-professed worth, which is hysterical, right? But, like, I think that, you know, you can throw in, hey, you know, I might even take away some of your imaginary money in this proposal. You know, if you really can't resist trying to goad him. But I think that the overall things in some odd ways are just to hit those same themes that got Obama over Romney. Now, obviously, Obama's a much, you know, kind of infinitely more talented politician than Hillary Clinton. But I think in some ways she just needs to make some very traditional arguments that are compelling to most people. And I think in the process, unlike Romney, and Romney's answers on those things didn't work, obviously, but he demonstrated, you know, we talked about competence. I don't think anybody questioned, you know, Mitt Romney knows what he's talking about. So I think in that way, you can get Donald Trump. I think anytime you bore into any details, it's going to go that he doesn't have any details. And then, you know, just stick him on stuff that isn't popular in any scenario, because I don't think that this sort of unique threat strategy has worked.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you there. I've very much been against the dangerous Donald strategy.
Yes.
Because I think it plays into his own messaging.
Exactly.
Of being a change agent.
Exactly.
And that's really Trump's Achilles heel, is he's not a change agent. I mean, he's, by his own self-description, he's somebody deeply baked into the corrupt process that he's critiquing.
Yep.
And so to say, oh, you're dangerous, oh, you're going to change things, actually plays into his hands.
Exactly.
I mean, I really think she ought to just have been running against dumb Donald. I mean, I think if he'd insulted his intelligence, that would have gone a lot further, both to get inside his head and also to cast him not as a truth teller, but as a simpleton. And for whatever reason, you know, even though the guy changes positions with an almost admirable flexibility. Of course, the same could be said of Clinton, actually. So, but you really have to emphasize the why, right? Mm-hmm. There's not even instrumental reasons a lot of the time with Trump, whereas, you know, it used to be said in Arkansas that Bill Clinton would climb a tree to tell a lie when the truth standing on the ground would do just fine. But, you know, at least then there typically seems to be a reason for the mendacity of the Clintons, whereas, like, Trump's is just almost visceral.
Well, I mean, and, look, lying's fun. I mean, it's true. Yeah. By the way, I did a great job with that. And I think you hear Luke Thompson. He's a loser, big time.
Yeah.
I mean, he was at Right to Rise. Okay. We all know about that.
All of the Pepe memes. So many Pepe memes.
I mean, you know, the irony is that the other experience that you and I share in life across our divides is we're in a specific subcategory of being real cucks.
Oh, totally. Just the worst.
Luke Thompson, my good friend, Republican political strategist, writer, partner at AppleCart. I will see you soon. Thanks so much, brother.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Thanks, man. Okay, everybody, we are going to go to the fun half. The IMs are on. I'm going to call to the phones in just a second, but you can join us at 646-257-3920. Hopefully that'll work. We have a bunch for you in the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's majority.fm/become a member. Tonight, our live coverage of the debate begins at 8:30. We're going to do about a half an hour pregame and then watch the debate where we will comment less. And then we'll do about a 15-20 minute postgame. Write us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast on iTunes. Write that a review as well. I've got a couple new reviews on that from that this week. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. See you on the fun half.